Okay, it's about 1:03 now. I think we have enough people that are on the line to get this meeting started. So thank you everybody for joining us today. So this is Corianne Nguyen, DEQ, Oregon Clean Fuels Program. And welcome to the fifth advisory rulemaking advisory committee for this rulemaking, Clean Fuels Electricity 2021 rulemaking. So today, the goal is to go over draft rules. So I know that this topic can be quite kind of meaty and a slog, but I definitely wanted to give you all the opportunity to actually look at some draft rule language. We know that there is definitely, you know, kind of an art to translating some of the discussion papers and the meeting summaries and the audio of the discussions that we've been having up till now until it makes it into rules. And so it's always important to be able to see those rules and make sure that what we talked about and what you submitted comments on and whatnot ends up reflected properly in the rules. And for a lot of you who haven't been, you know, involved in our rulemaking process before, you know, this is just kind of the next step in the process. So let's take a look at what the agenda for today's meeting is. So we will just provide kind of an overview and, you know, get you oriented to where we are in the process. We will look at rules. First, we are going to be looking at renewable electricity rules and the carbon intensity of the electricity and the incremental credits. And we'll start with that because obviously that's the media and most of the details and most of the discussion that we've had in this rulemaking advisory committee so far. We will take a break and then we will look at the rest of the rules pertaining to the energy economy ratios and advanced crediting and some of the other general provisions. For your reference, all of these draft rules are posted on our rulemaking webpage. I think you'll see four sets of draft rules there. And so there's a set on renewable electricity. There's a set on PER applications. There are a set on credit generation for electricity and then for the advanced crediting. Also know that we have another set of rules open that we are drafting, but it's basically it's all of the definitions that we're just going to have to add to this rulemaking. So, you know, some of these are terms of art and we'll need specific definitions. I don't have that ready for you today, but know that when we do see kind of full red line of Division 253 in the future, there will be changes and additions to the definitions rules as well. And we'll also be taking public comment at the end of the meeting, but if you do have questions, definitely raise your hand and use the chat box. I think in the previous meetings, we've been pretty good at managing the traffic of all the different questions, and we haven't really needed that extra comment period at the end. So we'll try and follow that format as well today. Again, some basic ground rules for this Zoom meeting. If you can make sure, I think in the chat, Bill's already put in the chat a reminder for everybody to have their name and their affiliation in your, as you sign in your participants, all of your questions. If you do have questions that you want to put in the chat, make sure that you have it to everyone so that the entire audience can actually see what the question is. If you want to speak, if you want to provide some kind of ask a question or provide a comment, please use your raise the hand button. It's on the participant panel. Or if you're on the phone, press *9 to raise your hand. Let's see. Okay. So, kind of to set the context of the timeline for the rulemaking, is this summary right here. So we have been through four of these meetings already, and today is the fifth with the draft rules. We have scheduled one additional meeting. It will be on the afternoon of December 1st. I believe that's a Tuesday, and to have the fiscal analysis discussion. So hopefully we can wrap up today some of the draft rules and hear what your comments and you know, proposed changes are for those. We will have some time for you to submit written comments for today, but know that we need to be working on this fiscal analysis and have it running for internal review very, very soon, early next week. So if you do have comments specific that you think will actually impact the fiscal impact of what the draft rules are, please get them to us as soon as possible. And then I'll stop here and actually make a note about this fiscal and economic analysis. The way that we're required to do this analysis is what is to assess what the potential impact is for this set of rules. So it rule changes. So it's not about the fiscal impact of the entire Clean Fuels program. It's about the proposed changes that we're making here. So keep that in mind when we you know, talk about what a fiscal impact is. We're still on a timeline, assuming that we can get the fiscal discussion in with this rulemaking advisory committee on December 1st. Our timeline is to get out a formal notice of proposed rulemaking, which is our formal comment period in late December, with public hearing in late January, and then the comment period ending in late January. And so that we can be on target to go to our Environmental Quality Commission for them to consider adoption of this rulemaking in March. I wanted to take a moment to go over, reiterate again, kind of a slide that we showed at meeting number one when we kicked off this rulemaking. And the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because, you know, I think because this rulemaking is focused on electricity, we have had a lot of discussions about the technical integrity of the carbon accounting, of the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, for this, for the provisions that we've talked about. And I think because we've kind of been head down so much in electricity, I wanted to remind everybody that this is still part of a larger clean fuels program that is, you know, technology and fuel neutral. We have had several comments about, you know, remember that any of the provisions that we're talking about here in electricity, could there be overlap in hydrogen, in natural gas, in some of the biofuels, you know, those kinds of things. And so, yes, I mean, not in this rulemaking, but in the next rulemaking when basically all of the provisions of the program will be within scope. And so, you know, we still try, our goal is to strive to achieve the real quantifiable greenhouse gas reductions through anything that we propose. We strive to use the best science that we provide, and we strive to provide incentives, you know, for technology development, for commercialization, and for deployment of these different, of the different cleaner fuels that will produce permanent paths to decarbonizing transportation. So just, you know, a little reminder that although this rulemaking is focused on electricity, we do have broader kind of scope that the program has to be able to address longer term. Okay. With that, actually, before we head into the draft rules, I just wanted to go around and introduce the DEQ staff that is participating today. Let's see. Why don't we go around to Bill?
Hi there. This is Bill Peters. I'm an analyst with the Clean Fuels Program.
Steph?
Hey, everybody. This is Stephanie Summers. I'm also an analyst with the Clean Fuels Program, primarily in the reporting portion.
And Tiara?
Hi, my name is Tiara Winans. I am the Life Cycle Assessment Specialist in the team.
Okay. Colin, did you make it into the room?
Yes, I did. I've been lurking here for about 5 minutes. I'm Colin McConaughey. I manage our Office of Greenhouse Gas Programs, and one of those programs is this Clean Fuels Program.
Do you have any words of wisdom for us today, Colin, as we kick off the draft rules discussion?
I do not. I am mentally sapped from having just come from a longer than expected discussion with our commission over one of our other greenhouse gas programs. Some of you may have been over there with me in a virtual sense. So I have no words of wisdom on this topic today. I was really fully prepared for the prior discussion and was just going to tune in and listen in. So I appreciate everybody's involvement today. I am interested to hear the discussion, but I don't really have much to add myself. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry for putting you on the spot, Colin.
No, totally fine.
Okay, so let's see. Does anybody kind of have any kind of questions before we head into the actual presentation? And yes, I mean, like always, we'll get the slides up after the meeting today. And then the other thing is we're trying to figure out, there were two late sets of comments that came in and we were trying to get posted. They may be up now. And I think if you kind of look at it's under the RAF number 4 comments on the rulemaking. I'm trying to pull it up now to see if it got posted. And it's loading, and it's loading, and it's loading, and it's stopped now. So, oh, yeah, so they have been loaded up. So two sets of comments that came in today and yesterday, I believe. And actually with that, what I wanted to do is one of the sets of comments that came in is from the, the investor-owned utilities from Portland General Electric and Pacific Core. And I wanted to give them the opportunity to tee up part of the comments that they submitted today that is relevant to this first part of the draft rules. And so the first part of what we're going to talk about is the renewable electricity provisions, the changing of the carbon intensities for electricity and the incremental credits. And so there are a large portion of their comments that are direct to this topic. And so I wanted to give either Greg Alderson or Eva maybe an opportunity to kind of go over that portion of your comments, because I think those are new to this discussion since the last time we met. So, Greg or Eva?
Sure, I can start. This is Greg Alderson from PGE. So, regarding the generation of incremental credits from residential charging, PGE and Pacific Core heard from stakeholders in this context that there was a lot of interest in both a reach of clean fuels programs that would be beyond just a single utility and also that would have a greater equity element, both in terms of input into how the funds were spent and then how, the actual use of the dollars. And so, what we proposed in our comment, and I'll just be very brief here, you all able to review it yourselves, is a formal collaboration that creates sort of one pot that dedicates half of the dollars from the sale of residential incremental credits to underserved and equity communities related to transportation electrification, and would include representatives of those communities in designing the use of those funds that are dedicated to TE for those purposes. We believe that can be done through the existing UM 1826 process, which is just the stakeholder engagement process through the PUC through which utilities, clean fuels activities are vetted with stakeholders in the commission. And so it creates kind of one single pot to be utilized for those purposes across our service territories with a greater eye and engagement with equity and underserved communities. So there that's that piece. And then Corey, you asked about carbon intensity. So I'll just speak to that real quick. And then if you want to talk about the REC part of our comment, I think Mary Winky from PAC is on the phone and can speak to that. On the carbon intensity, just quickly, you know, PAC and PGE continue to be concerned, you know, by the proposal to remove all the utilities that have a specific CI, just because that sends the statewide grid intensity up. And that has an impact not just on the residential charging generation, but also on non-residential charging, you know, by fleet or other customers in our territories. And so we, you know, just continue to raise that point and, you know, put forward the fact that, you know, we think that, you know, that is not something that is purely necessary and, you know, it could have some impact on charging in our territories in terms of credit generation. And if you would like us to speak to the REC parts of our comment, Mary can do that. Otherwise, happy to cede the floor back to you.
Yeah, maybe we'll save the comments for the REC thing as we get into the section of the rules. Eva, did you want to add anything at all?
Hey, I think Greg covered a lot of the incremental section and the CI piece, but Mary is really our expert on the REC, so I think she's going to summarize it, and then I will add some color commentary further in the discussion as needed.
Okay, thanks, Eva. Jana, did you want to add in any comments here?
Yeah, thanks. This is Jana Gaston with the Oregon Environmental Council. And there's a group of folks on the REC who've been really interested in more of a statewide aggregation for incremental credits that could be more equity focused, with the idea that, again, I think pointing back to comments from the last REC, that there's a lot of sort of learning and information sharing that really can and should be happening on a statewide basis, especially when it comes to thinking about community developed projects. And capacity is thin, right? And so how do we get sort of a centralized way to do that? And also build capacity, build ownership and leadership for more transportation electrification in the state. And so I think there's a couple of different models for how to do that. But oftentimes the nonprofit model is one that works really well for engagement and opportunities to really do more community engagement and outreach. Ultimately, you know, this is about talking to people. It's about finding out what their needs are and how electrification can help. And then there's also the technical assistance and kind of grant administrative pieces. And so we'd really like to see something that creates a really holistic type of program and process in Oregon. There's great opportunities for electrification to help communities and help service providers cut fuel costs. Lower maintenance costs. And so we really want to be able to see how that can really be leveraged throughout Oregon and how the Clean Fuels Program can help contribute to that. So all that is to say, we're interested in that kind of a centralized incremental credit aggregator model as well.
Okay. Thanks. And so why don't we do this? I'm gonna pass it over now to Bill to kind of walk through the kind of the next part of the presentation.
Yeah, thanks. And Mary, I promise the REC slide is only a couple ahead, so I just wanna try and do that all at once. Okay, so thanks everybody. Just a quick note on reading the slides. Which, as Corey said earlier, will get posted on the website at some point soon. So the regular text or the current proposals, we'll try and flag at the top of the slides if you know, you're looking at proposals we have, if it's going to be direct text, or if we're, you know, cleaning up comments that we got and we're able to include in the deck. So red text, we tried to flag where we've changed the proposal from a prior meeting. Green text are specific questions we're seeking input on. I'm going to try and pause for questions, clarifying or otherwise, as we go in a couple different places, but feel free to just type in a question as it occurs to you in the chat box or raise your hand if you have questions or comments you'd like to make. And then in italics and in kind of the brownish gray text, those are texts from the draft rules as they're currently posted. So so we're starting off with the renewable energy provisions and the carbon and the carbon intensive electricity provisions. So I wanted to go back to the goals that we stated during meeting three for these provisions. Our goal with these provisions, especially for the addition of renewable electricity provisions to the program, is to provide a clear signal for more renewable energy generation. And as the number of electric vehicles grow in the state, the EQ believes that the additional demand imposed upon the grid can and should be met with electricity supplied by zero carbon resources. We believe that allowing a range of options to help send that signal, but as a qualification for renewable energy, should be carefully defined to maintain the environmental integrity of the program and make sure that we're requiring similar levels of stringency here as we require in other parts of the program. So moving on from that. So we haven't, on the electricity carbon intensity portion of the proposal, what hasn't changed is that we're proposing to move from the five-year rolling averages for the statewide utility safe mixes to a one-year average, that we're planning to adjust the statewide mix for utility civic carbon intensities, and that the direct emissions associated with the Boardman coal-fired plant, which recently retired, will be replaced by an emissions factor of 0.428 tons per megawatt hour for the 2021 and 2022 statewide mixes, as there's a lag in when we get the electricity data reported to DEQ. So both 2021 and 2022's mixes will include data from years where Boardman was in operation. The other provision, which we, I think, teed up in the last meeting, was that if the Environmental Quality Commission chooses to adopt this rulemaking and these changes to the way that we calculate statewide mix and utility service mixes, DEQ may reissue those mixes early next year. So we have to post the mix for 2021 this December under the current rules. We would continue to move forward and do that under our current rule structure. And then if the Environmental Quality Commission adopts these rules at their March meeting or the subsequent meeting, we would propose and reissue the 2021 electricity CIs. On renewable electricity, what hasn't changed from our last proposal is that RECs and utility green power products, and I'm just going to note that utility green power products is the term that we're going to define in the rule to cover both green tariffs and then the more traditional REC-backed renewable energy products that utilities offer. Or if you guys think there's a better name for that, please let us know. We're trying to find something that would cover both the bundled and unbundled energy and REC products. So what hasn't changed since last proposal is that either of those methods would be allowed to, it would be able to lower the carbon intensity of electricity for residential and non-residential charging, that we would deem renewable energy from solar, wind, geothermal, hydropower, and ocean power in the rules as having a carbon intensity of zero, and that for renewable energy from biomass, biogas, biodiesel, and hydrogen, that those electricity generators would need to come in for a tier two pathway in order for their RECs or bundled products to have a carbon intensity, and that would be in line with how we treat any of those if they were coming in for, as part of another fuel. And then the utility green power products may apply for recognition in the program that receiving a specific carbon intensity using a modified tier two fuel pathway application process. One change from the last proposal that we have in the draft rules is that we're proposing to also allow for power purchase agreements to receive a CI in a similar manner to the utility green power products. And that was in response to a comment about from one of the charger operators. And Mary, please go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were going to call me so immediately. I just had a question on this power purchase agreement. Would that be like a separate apart from a REC, or would you have to have the energy and the REC? Would it be like a bundled product?
Yeah, that would be for bundled products.
You know what I'm asking?
Yeah, okay. So our vision there is just for the bundled products. If there is a somebody buying from an electric service supplier, if I'm remembering the right acronym and how to deacronym that, that the bundled renewable power would be used for that non-residential applications. I don't believe residential customers are allowed to buy power from anyone other than the utilities. And there is a question and a comment on this from Andrew Dick of Electrify America. Are there geographic restrictions on location of products supported through PPAs or location of projects supported through PPAs? So the chargers would have to be in the state of Oregon, and then the existing, this is actually in two slides, so I'll get, I should have probably just held it for a second, but we have some minor changes to the geographic scope of renewable electricity for this rulemaking that we're proposing, and I'll bring that up then, but it's basically we're keeping the existing proposal but adding the Pacific Core East balancing authority. Jana, I see your hand raised. Do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Jana Gaston with Oregon Environmental Council. Just quickly, are you thinking about like a PPA, like who would be first in line for those credits? Is it the sort of the entity purchasing that power, making that agreement, or just curious if this, I like the idea of having sort of a green power product that can be an umbrella, but then just wondering if each of these mechanisms plays out a little differently or not.
Yeah, our goal for that would just be that it would be going to an entity that is already a credit generator in some way, like a forklift fleet, public charging. And so they the regular credit generator would be able to generate the credits with the carbon intensity of the electricity from the PPA. They would, you know, it would basically have all the same provisions as the other renewable electricity products are required to have. And that actually answers my question to the comments, which is, yeah, the PPAs would have the same broad eligibility rules as REC that they have. You know, if they're from one of these sources that would require a tier two pathway, we'd also need to get the carbon intensity information from there. And that they would still have the in-service date requirements. So I'm going to move on quickly to the next two slides and then stop for comments there, and then also go back to this question here, but we're maintaining from the prior proposal that eligible RECs must be GREENY certified and placed in service after 2015. We did get a set of comments, and this is one of the two later sets of comments that we got that Corey mentioned earlier from dairy biogas generators who argued that their existing power purchase agreements will be expiring in their future. And that basically the current price of power for their projects, if they went back out on the market, is too low to support them. Going back to some of our principles I mentioned earlier, you know, we are trying to have these rules result in additional renewable energy. So we're posing the question on if there is a rationale for carving out just the source of electric generation from the place in service date. And then the next comment, or the next bit of rule text I'll get to and then take questions, is that from the rule text, we have made a change here on the geographic scope of RECs, which is that in addition to within a balancing authority area that includes Oregon, that we would also allow for the Pacific Core East balancing authority area, given how the emissions reporting works for that and power flow between the eastern and western parts of the core system. And also that, as we mentioned last time, this part hasn't changed, but if the electricity is being delivered into one of the balancing authority areas that includes Oregon on a real-time basis, that would also qualify. So I'll stop here. Mary, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. I do apologize that I have not been in all of these meetings and privy to all of the conversations, so I apologize in advance if I'm treading over ground that's already been covered. But I think the challenge with this is that this is a different geographic limitation than our current voluntary Blue Sky program. And I'm struggling to kind of understand, and I appreciate the inclusion of FACE. I think that's really critical for Pacificorp, but I also feel like if we have to take if we're able to use Blue Sky REC, which I think is a really good approach, we'd have to somehow bifurcate amongst the Blue Sky REC to figure out what's eligible for CFP and what's eligible for Blue Sky. And I don't really see the rationale for having a difference there. And so I'm just curious if you talk about that. And then also a rationale for having something different than the state RPS, you know, parameters. You know, it just seems like this should be rooted, being an Oregon program should be rooted in something that exists already rather than kind of creating something new and a kind of different bucket of eligibility. You know, I'm concerned about the geographic eligibility, less concerned about the 2015 cutoff, but I'm just curious kind of the rationale for this.
Yeah, so I'll try and briefly describe those. So the rationale for not going with the RPS requirements or just mirroring the RPS requirements was that we felt that, you know, in some cases, recs that were eligible for the RPS wouldn't work for the program, given how it's set up. For example, thermal recs that are in the RPS, you know, would not be applicable to megawatt hours of electricity, right? So we didn't feel like those would work. The other main piece of why I went with Green rather than the RPS in terms of the eligibility requirements was that we needed to, because this is a carbon program and we need to have the electricity that RECs or renewable power is being applied to maintain the claim that the carbon intensity of that electricity is zero or whatever we assign to it through the tier two application process, we felt that the Green E program would do a better job of that than the RPS. That's also part of the rationale for the 2015 date. One, that's the baseline year for our program. So we felt that, you know, if we're trying to ensure that the carbon intensity is zero and that these renewable energy generators are already included in the statewide mix, that was our way of balancing, you know, the carbon accounting and ensuring that credits generated in the program represent real emissions reductions. Does that help?
Well, and I think in addition, Bill, it's not just that the accounting is within the area, but that, you know, that I think we received a lot of comments about, you know, wanting to see benefits to Oregon as well. So, you know, in as much as those projects would be based in Oregon to benefit Oregonians.
Okay. I guess I get the distinction you're drawing between the RPS, but I'm definitely still struggling with the distinction on the Blue Sky program, just in our case, because I think the same kind of general, all of the principles that you laid out there to apply to this apply, I think, to the Blue Sky program as well. I mean, it's a Green E tariff or Green E certified program. There's a desire to have a link to Oregon and have that benefit be, you know, an Oregon specific benefit. I feel like that's achieved in that program, even though you don't have the same type of geographic restriction. So I think, you know, even if you have something that is applicable to PPA or RECs purchased on the, just in the REC market, you know, you might have a geographic restriction, but it just seems like at a minimum, you'd want to align this geographic scope with the utility green programs that are already in place.
Yeah, and actually, let me go through this slide quickly and then go back to Annabelle since she has her hand raised. But to respond directly to what you're saying, Mary, so our proposal is that for the utility renewable energy products, that what we would look at is if the green tariff, the Blue Sky in your case, if there are enough qualifying RECs to cover the transportation-related claims under the program. So not that every REC that is being retired on behalf of that product needs to meet the requirements that we're specifying for the Clean Fuels program in the current proposal, but that, you know, enough of those megawatt hours cover the estimated megawatt hours of charging from, you know, transportation uses. So that was how we were thinking about incorporating the existing programs. You know, I haven't had a chance to look through. I mean, I saw you guys have the portfolio or disclosure on your website, it doesn't really give me a good sense of where the RECs are from. So if you guys have better public information on that, I'd be happy to take a look at these requirements versus the existing sources and see how they match up.
Okay, yeah, we can definitely send you that information.
Okay. And then Annabelle, I'm going to go back one, and I'll probably have to represent part of that slide, but Annabelle, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I was just wondering if you could explain the benefit of adding the Pacific Coast Balancing Authority area into the eligibility and how that aligns with some of the original kind of geographic and deliverability benefits that were laid out.
I might defer to the court about explaining their system here, but my understanding, and in their comments, they said that, you know, they operate the system from both geographic areas as one single system, and so this was our attempt to recognize that.
Yeah, and I'll just add too. I mean, I think what's kind of compelling for me is that the resources, the emitting resources that are in Pacific Core East, are included in the statewide mix. So it seems like there is a real nexus there in terms of what this program is considering as sort of the Oregon mix. So it's kind of direct link there.
Okay. Thanks. Michael Graham, you're up.
Hey, thanks, Bill. So I'm struggling with the 2015 in-service date. So, like, I look at the Oregon Department of Energy's solar dashboard, and I see that there's 71,569 megawatt hours that came online as a running total before 2014 and older. So it seems like that's going to exclude a lot of in-state solar generation that I would think would be eligible. And then also there's quite a few biogas digesters and also landfills across the state that may not have access to natural gas pipelines that have generators producing electricity that are older than 2015. So we're also going to exclude those, which are serving a pretty good purpose in destroying what would be fugitive methane emissions and also helping support, you know, municipalities that are going to struggle with renewing their PPAs. So I wonder if there's a way that we could carve out, you know, some of these 2015 generators to, you know, include them in the CFP program.
Yeah, so that was part of the latter part of your comment was why we teed up the question on the dairy biogas generators. I would say, and remind folks, right, the statewide mix takes into account the carbon intensity of all electricity that's being delivered into the state. That includes the legacy hydro from BPA's Model Power Administration SAM system. That would also include, you know, a lot of the older renewable energy generators that that party is, you know, being purchased by the utilities and has a carbon intensity of zero under DEQ's greenhouse gas reporting program, which is the data source that we're using here. So the purpose of that 2015 date was, you know, one, it aligns with the baseline year for the Clean Fuels Program, and then two, it's about us trying to reach for additional renewable energy on top of, you know, the existing sources. So, you know, we are trying to create a balance there. I think that there is an argument around, you know, these dairy generators really will go away because the, you know, market power prices are too low to support their operations. I think that's something that, you know, we've indicated that we will take further comment on. But, yeah, I think that is just our goal, was to try and incent additional renewables.
I think the PPA issue and renewing like older PPAs, I think that that issue is not just focused on one source. I think that, you know, existing renewable generators are going to have similar issues with the market.
Okay. Yeah, we're happy to take further comments on that. I think that one of the things I'd be interested in seeing those comments is just some discussion of, you know, where their ongoing fuel, labor, costs, you know, solar panels may have some, but those are probably relatively small versus a dairy where, you know, depending on the setup, there might be trucking involved for the manure and other things, or for a biomass generator that's, you know, constantly purchasing and, you know, hauling biomass.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And just going in order of the hands raised, Greg, you're up next, and then John, and then Mary.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. This is Greg from PG. I want to note a couple things. One, I think there's an important distinction for DEQ to recognize Our green source program is a green certified program. The individual RECs itself, themselves are not each individually green E certified. And so I think if DEQ is trying to, as we have hoped that they would, facilitate the use of those voluntary programs, I think we need to be very careful about how that's written, because the current rules specify that the individual RECs, I believe, must be green E certified. So we'd be happy to talk in more detail about that, but just wanted to raise that concern. And also just underline our continuing recommendation that DEQ avoid specialized requirements as are currently proposed for the RECs here, alignment with or consistency with the RPS eligibility across the WEC, all make sense in view of both questions about the REC market in the sort of out years of this kind of proposal, and also just in terms of procuring and availability and cost of procuring those RECs in the different cases that the program provides for it.
Thanks. Thanks for your comment generally. I will just respond briefly to the first part. I'll note that in the draft rules, and I think I forgot to put this in the slide, but I should have, our review of utility green power products and PPAs, there's language in there saying that we would determine if the, basically, if the products result in substantially similar environmental outcomes to the sources of renewable energy required for unbundled RECs. So in that case, we wouldn't necessarily require that each individual underlying REC in those utility green power products be certified on their own. We would take the overall certification. Does that make sense?
That's a helpful clarification of what was meant by looking at the same environmental outcome or something like that.
Yes, yeah.
I was not sure what you meant there.
Okay. Well, that's the purpose of these meetings. And, you know, I'll mark that as an area where we can probably clarify it before we get to the next meeting.
Clarity in the rule there would be appreciated. Thanks very much.
Okay. John and then Mary.
Thanks, Bill. John Fulton, Think Teacher. So I wanted to echo Greg's comments about not having specialized requirements and encourage you to look at Regis-wide or WEC-wide, particularly since if you're allowing, you know, Utah, Idaho, or Wyoming, you're already encompassing a substantial part of the, you know, the WEC. And then the other thing, you were asking for questions about the biogas. I would encourage you to look at maybe it's should be biomass or any tier two, because there are other, it's not just strictly dairy biogas, but there are other biogas and biomass sources that are kind of in that same situation in the PPAs.
Thank you for your comment. Mary, please go ahead.
Oh, yes. I just had a clarifying question from what you said before about the voluntary RECs. Were you saying that all the RECs and our voluntary program will qualify to lower RCI, or were you saying that some subset of them would?
What I was saying, what's in the proposal now, is that so you've got the, you know, the pie of all the RECs that are in there, and what we would look at for determining if that product could qualify for carbon intensity of zero, or depending where the sources are, whatever that carbon intensity would be. So instead of looking at all the RECs, we would just look at enough RECs meet the requirements or are substantially similar to the requirements to cover the transportation related use of the product. So if, you know, you have 200,000 megawatt hours of electricity in that product, but only 10,000 of those megawatt hours are going to electric vehicles, then we would just look at 10,000 megawatt hours. Does that help?
Yes, yes. Okay, but those, the would the geographic restrictions that you have on the slide apply to those 10,000 RECs that you're using?
Yes, that's what we're currently proposing and we would take comment on.
Okay, okay.
Okay, Evan, do you want to go?
Yeah, I think so. This is Evan with ChargePoint. Just wanted to see if you guys could elaborate on the value add of requiring RECs to be green certified, given that it seems like, and maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems like all of these REC eligibility requirements are already tracked in Regis.
Yeah, so the value add for Greeny is that Greeny, as part of their certification process, and we talked about this at one of the earlier meetings, I'm going to blank on which one it was. You know, our goal here is to maintain the carbon claim for the electricity that's being backed by RECs, because, you know, we have a life cycle carbon intensity program. You know, we need to be assured that the carbon intensity associated with the retirement of these RECs and the claims associated with those, you know, do represent a carbon intensity of zero, in order to, you know, assign that carbon intensity to electricity being served in Oregon, and then, you know, generate credits. So this is really, our goal there was to use Greeny to provide that assurance, since they already do it through their existing program. And that would also cut down, and part of the consideration there was also just that, you know, the clean fuel staff is for people, and, you know, we felt that using an existing certification that was well understood by the market, you know, would help cut down on our administrative burden with implementing this provision.
So then, if I'm not, doesn't Greeny require a commercial online date of 2001, or maybe that's a rolling 15-year window? So aren't those eligibility requirements broader than these?
Yes. So that was something we talked about in the prior meeting. We are requiring for the start date and for the geographic restrictions something that is in excess of the current Greeny standard.
Okay, so it's going to be like a new Greeny standard.
I wouldn't go that far. It's, you know, we would, you know, Greeny would certify the product as meeting Greeny standard. We would then take a look at those RECs and the REC retirement report from Regis or another registry, if you recognize another registry, in order to determine, you know, when the start date was and the balancing authority area where the power is being delivered to. So it's, you know, I mean, in terms of how somebody in a broker market might discuss it, yeah, it might be a little bit different, but, you know, we're not requiring, like, you know, CRS and Greeny aren't going to, like, create a separate version of product.
Okay, thanks.
Annabelle, please go ahead. And I think I've got one or two questions in the chat box I'll take.
Yeah, thank you. Repeating a lot of this has been really helpful for me as well. Definitely a lot of complex topics. I'm curious if DEQ plans to address or at a minimum monitor issues related to double counting. I think we've raised, there's multiple types of double counting, I think, to consider, but one of the concerns that the Northwest Energy Coalition has raised is that electricity associated with a REC retired for the Clean Fuels Program could ultimately get sold in, down into California and potentially be counted as a zero emission resource under their cap and trade program, resulting in potential double counting of that carbon intensity, essentially. And so I'm wondering if you plan to track or monitor occurrences like that.
Yeah, I mean, insofar as we're able to without getting all the tags, I think generally what I would say is that, you know, we work to maintain the environmental integrity of the Clean Fuels Program. You know, when we add provisions like this, we always attempt to monitor their effectiveness and make sure that we have not degraded the environmental integrity of the program accidentally. So we would continue to try and do that. You know, I think that is an issue that I saw Todd from CRS raise in written comments that he submitted to us. So I think that they're also looking at that, and I think that is something that we would keep an eye on. Eva, please go ahead.
I think it's important to just reiterate and emphasize the point we've made in all these conversations, which these apply not just to, you know, residential-based credits or rather incremental credits, but in addition on any participating in the clean fuel marketplace. And again, if the overall goal of this rulemaking is to further support electric transportation in Oregon, kind of be more straightforward and easy to comply while still meeting the metrics and goals, the more folks will be able to participate and benefit from and further electric transportation in Oregon. So absolutely feel and understand the challenge of being, you know, resource restricted. And so I think if there's a way to balance that, it's really, there's an opportunity to further electric transportation in Oregon through the Clean Fuels Program. And that's at the end of the day what this executive order set for.
Gotcha. Thank you. I'm going to take two quick questions that are in the chat box and then keep going to the slides. So Mark Ventura from Philip 66 has a question about no behind the meter requirement for a PPA. So yes, Mark, that's right. So for so if somebody has a power purchase agreement, you know, if I've got a bunch of electric car chargers and I've gotten a power purchase agreement with an electric service provider, there wouldn't be a requirement that, you know, the renewable electricity be behind the meter of the same meter as those chargers. I would need, and with the documentation requirements, you know, they would need to show that they're buying electricity under this PPA that's been qualified through DEQ, and that they maintain that qualification, that they're buying that renewable power. And then there's a question from James Brotherton. Why does hydrogen fall under a Tier 2 pathway? And James, that's because hydrogen as a transportation fuel will be required to go through a pathway process similar to biodiesel, similar to biogas, similar to biomass. We do judge that there are a number of forms of hydrogen that we can anticipate that would have carbon intensities associated with them. So hydrogen used in fuel cells to generate electricity should go through the same pathway application process as, you know, hydrogen that is going directly into a vehicle. And is being, you know, the hydrogen is being used to produce electricity there to power the motors. You know, and I would note that we do have a number of lookup table pathways for hydrogen in our rules for that purpose that already identify the carbon intensive hydrogen being generated, you know, in the state using a statewide mix versus a BPA mix. Okay, and I'm not seeing any other hands raised, so I'm going to try and get through the next couple slides and then stop again for a couple questions. So first off, and I showed this slide very quickly earlier. For the utility renewable energy products and power purchase agreements, that would go through a tier 2 application process through DEQ. That application process would be a little different than our normal tier 2 fuel pathway applications, and we would require that the application package include a letter describing whatever the product is, what the existing or planned source or sources of electricity for that product is, or RECs, and the terms by which it's being offered to customers. So just broadly understanding, you know, is this a PPA and it needs to be offered in this way, or is it, you know, a, you know, the Blue Sky or Green Source programs that are just more generally available. For our, helping us determining whether somebody who's on one of these products is meeting, or, you know, is actually on that, so that when they submit documentation to us, we understand, like, yes, they're actually on Blue Sky or another green product. We'd require that samples or examples of bills, invoices, or other documentation that somebody claiming renewable energy under this provision would provide the DEQ be provided to us, so that we, you know this is what documentation should look like. So that when some, you know, credit generator elsewhere in the program submits documentation to us, we can say, no, we need to see this piece of paper, this utility invoice. In the case of a utility renewable energy product, we're proposing to require any filings with or orders by the PC or a local governing board that approves the product be submitted to us. So in the case of the IOUs, that would be the PC. If there is one of these products that would come in from COU, then we would ask that, you know, similar documentation or approval be submitted. But, you know, if that doesn't quite work for utility, please let us know. And then finally, the last element, and this is for that portion about, like, figuring out what part of the pie would be used for transportation, is an estimate of the amount of electric vehicle charging attributable to customers for the product or agreement. We request that estimate for the first time once reporting is actually occurring in the CFP online system. We would likely issue specific fuel pathway codes for each of these products that are approved. So similarly to how we have like probably close to 24 electricity carbon intensities per year right now for all of the utility specific mixes, as well as statewide mix, we'd start issuing additional fuel pathway codes for each green tariff or renewable energy product. And we would allow them for future years when this is being updated through the annual fuel pathway report. We would share the amount of charging that is being reported to DEQ as occurring under these products and other fuel pathway codes with the utility so they can help them update those estimates. I did actually include this in the slide, and I'd forgotten about that. So the standard review for these products, like I mentioned earlier, would be to determine if the renewable energy is substantially similar in its environmental outcome to the unbundled REC provisions that we have. You know, we would use that estimate, and this is where I was talking about the slice of the pie, we'd use the estimate of how much transportation-related charging is occurring in order to determine if, you know, it's substantially similar to the unbundled REC provision. You know, we would keep an eye on that and revisit that when we get the annual fuel pathway report each year. The annual fuel pathway report, which is required for all fuel producers that have a carbon intensity in our system across different fuels. For normally, if it was like an ethanol plant, that would include updated carbon intensity information on their invoices. That's also the report we would require verification for biofuel producers. We're not proposing verification for this provision because it's green, because of the green certification for unbundled RECs, and we'd have to talk through what ongoing evidence we provided for the any product that wasn't certified by somebody else. But the annual fuel pathway report here for these products would just be to update the source or sources of electricity or environmental attributes that were used in the prior year, along with an update of the estimate for how much electric vehicle charging is occurring. So I just talked a bunch. I'm going to pause here. I don't see any hands raised, but I'll just pause for a second. And if anyone wants to throw anything in the chat, please feel free to do so. Okay, I'm going to keep moving on.
Actually, Bill, let me ask you a question, and I apologize since we didn't really talk about this ahead of time, but I know it comes up later as well, too. So under the implementation of the third-party verification rules that we are currently working on, holders of pathways in the future starting in 2021 and moving 2021 data, so 2022, right, pathway holders will be subject to third-party verification. So was the idea here to include these electricity-related pathway holders to be subject to third-party verification or not?
So currently we don't require, so that in Division 272, which is the third-party verification division in the chapter of Oregon regulations that DEQ owns, we don't require electricity to go through verification or electricity credit generators to go through verification, and that's because we feel like the data capture requirements are fairly high and the risk of error is relatively low. I'll call out later that for the EER application pathway that we have a provision in the draft rules that would allow us when we're certifying an EER application that we could require verification of the annual report going forward. And I think that that's a judgment call that we're making. We're not, the current proposed rules would not require verification on these annual fuel pathway reports, nor would the structure of the existing rules in 272, which is the third-party verification division. And I see Greg has his hand raised. So Greg, do you want to go ahead?
Yes. Can you go back one slide?
Sure.
Thank you. I just wanted to, and perhaps this is a conversation to have offline because it's more particular to some of these utility products, but understand how DEQ will think about what a substantially similar environmental outcome is and sufficient renewable energy that is substantially similar. Because is that essentially just applying the same
REC kind of standards from the other section and just sort of looking at if the resources are similar types. I just want to understand how that sort of substantially similar would be judged, but that can be a separate conversation if that's better.
Yeah, I think that that's a good question to ask. I think that's something that I was thinking through and that we were thinking through as we're trying to draft these rules. What we were intending by substantially similar environmental outcome was that, you know, I think the example you raised earlier about, like, you know, not every REC being certified by Greenie, but the overall product is certified by Greenie is one of those things that results in a substantially similar outcome. You know, we might have some minor variances depending on the product. You know, I think that in a discussion we had, you know, there's, a bundled product that might not go through Greenie was raised as potential and as a potential option for this kind of provision. And that was what we were thinking of, was giving us enough flexibility when we're doing our review of these products to determine if, yeah, it doesn't meet the exact requirements, but it's similar enough that, and it largely meets the spirit of the requirements, we can prove it. Does that help? And if you have specific questions related to something, you know, I think we're happy to talk offline about that.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks. Annabelle, you want to go?
Yeah, and you might be getting to this a little bit later, but I think early on in this renewable electricity section, it says the existing proposal, and under that existing proposal, it mentioned that DEQ plans to remove the utility-specific carbon intensity from the statewide mix if they've opted out. I didn't see that, and maybe I missed that in the draft rules for renewable electricity, and I just wanted to clarify to see if DEQ doesn't need to include that in the rules to kind of account, or like more accurately account, for the carbon intensity.
So I think that we're still working on some of the draft rules, and I think that there are a couple of provisions that I've got down on my checklist that's still needing to draft, including the definitions, and there's also one or two other provisions that I'll mention later. That is our intent, and our proposal is to remove the utility-specific mixes from the statewide mix. It might need to be clarified or explicitly written into rule text. I think we're still reviewing that internally.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that.
Thanks. And I'm not seeing any other hands raised or comments in the chat box. If there's anything else on renewable electricity, please let me know. Because we're about to move into the more who gets to generate the credits section. Okay, so in terms of incremental credits, what hasn't changed since the last proposal is that the utility is first in line to claim incremental credits from residential charging in our service territory, followed by the incremental aggregator, which we'll explain later, and that the credit generator for base credits can claim incremental credits for everything else. So if you're already an existing non-residential credit generator, in addition to the base credits, you can use these provisions to also claim incremental credits. What has changed since last proposal is that we're proposing that the incremental aggregator, when we select one, can also claim incremental credits, where the credit generator of those base credits does not claim the incremental credits, which feels like a tongue twister, even though I wrote it. What we meant there was that, you know, if there is a credit generator, public charging station, a forklift fleet, where they generate the base credits, but they choose not to generate incremental credits for the retirement or purchase of renewable electricity, that we would allow the incremental aggregator to retire RECs on behalf of that charging and generate incremental credits. So for incremental credits from REC retirements, what we would require is that they submit documentation that qualifying RECs were retired in a recognized renewable electricity tracking system at the same time as the submittal of the quarterly report. And the question I want to throw out there and get more feedback on is, so quarterly reports are required to be submitted 90 days roughly after the close of a calendar quarter. So we're asking, is that enough time for folks to purchase and retire RECs against that charging? We could also envision doing it on a like semi-annual basis for some of these generators if they would like to. So I think that's a question that we're going to throw out there. You know, is there a sufficient lag between when the RECs are generated in Regis or another tracking system that we would have that, that there would be a concern there or not. And then for the utility green power products and power purchase agreements, submit documentation at least annually that the electric vehicle chargers or charging equipment is covered by one of those products that has been approved by DEQ for carbon intensity. The carbon intensity, and then there's also a requirement that the carbon intensity for that approved product is can only be used while the charger is under that same product or agreement. Mary, I see your hand raised. Do you want to go ahead?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to make a comment about the timing of the of the REC purchase and retirement. I'd ask if we could follow up on that because I don't have my Regis expert right here, but I do know that there are very specific timelines in terms of when transfers occur, how RECs are generated. You know, there's definitely a three-month lag between the generation and the REC creation. So I would just want to check with our folks to see what the kind of timing restraints would be.
Gotcha. And that's a good reminder. I don't think we put it in these slides, but we're proposing to go the same vintage requirements as Greenie. So it's the last 6 months of the prior year, the entirety of the current year, and the first 3 months of the next year. RECs generated in that period could be retired against charging. So I don't know if that.
But I know, like, I do believe that the way that we do it for Blue Sky is that that's the vintage eligibility, but then we go through an audit every year, and the RECs don't actually get retired until after that audit. So I believe the RECs aren't actually retired.
Okay.
On an annual basis. I think that's right, but I can find out from the people who are closer to that how that works.
Okay. Thanks. And I'll just note that for these two, it's just for the non-residential charging. So for the utility green power products and for residential charging, that would occur on a different schedule since the credit generation is on a different schedule in the quarterly reports.
Got it.
But yeah, we should talk, I'd be happy to talk that through and make sure that we get the timing lined up. John, I see your hand raised. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I just was going to suggest that the requirement ought to be on a rolling basis or rolling window basis, and then just to retire the RECs with the quarterly report, and that rolling requirement, you know, should be broad enough. We had proposed a two-year window, so you can basically, you know, retire either that quarter or reaching back up to 2 years, and then that would be allow enough time.
So let me ask your question that will get you to restate that just to make sure I'm getting it straight in my head. So you're saying that you would ask that RECs retired for this program's purpose be able to count even if they were retired like 24 months previously to the actual charging occurring?
No, so let me clarify. So basically the REC eligibility would be based on the vintage generation of the REC. So if we're reporting on, for instance, Q3,
mm-hmm.
you could use a Q3 REC, but technically that would never be minted. You know, that would never be created enough time for Regis, but you could reach back and use a Q1, you know, Q2, Q1, Q4 going back in time. So that would set the eligibility window, and then you would essentially be retiring RECs of that in that eligibility window when you're filing your quarterly report.
Okay, so this would move us off of the Greenie standard then, right, because they have a 21-month. Okay.
Yeah, which actually seems to be more straightforward because, you know, again, on a rolling quarterly basis, it's going to get pretty confusing to try to reconcile Greenie for reporting transactions that were way in the past. You know, in essence, we're going to retire RECs each quarter mm-hmm. and have it matched up with the charging load, and that, you know, that's a nice bundle versus trying to, like, you know, like Mary said, you're going to audit once a year later and kind of reach back, that's going to get pretty confusing looking across multiple quarters.
Okay. I think additional written comments would be helpful, but I'll also go back and take a look at the ones you submitted last week.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Thanks. And there is.
Yeah, but let me jump in here, Bill. So, but I think the part that I'm kind of I'm struggling with a little bit is, You know, I think there is definitely a difference, I think Bill pointed to it, a difference between the non-residential, you know, participants here that are submitting quarterly reports to generate the credits and, you know, wanting to have the retirement of those recs at that same kind of frequency, as opposed to the residential ones that we are granting, that we're proposing to move to a semi-annual kind of basis for, right? So, I mean, those are definitely two different time frames and requirements that we should think about, right, Bill?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I'll go back one slide quickly, but, you know, this is just for the incremental credits that are due to RECs being retired on behalf of the charging in a quarterly report. And so we're just asking, you know, if qualifying RECs can be found or retired, and that's still within that, you know, 21-month Green A vintage window. And so, you know, if it's Q3, to use John's example, then that would allow RECs that were from Q2, Q1, Q4, or the prior Q4 or the prior Q3 to qualify, given my understanding of the way their vintage requirements work. So, yeah, I think what we're just trying to ensure is that, you know, if we get a RAC retirement report from Regis submitted with the quarterly report in order to ensure that we can, you know, do our checking to make sure that the, you know, claimed carbon intensity of zero is backed up by something, that, you know, we're ensuring that we have the evidence there that, you know, the claim is valid. John, do you have anything else to add there?
No, that's correct. So Corey, I was referring to non-residential charging on a quarterly reporting and retirement. So that's correct.
Okay. Thanks, John.
All right. And then Mark Ventura with Club 66 has a question in the chat. Other than the electric utilities and the aggregator, are other entities, private or public, eligible to generate incremental credits? So Mark, the answer there is yes. Any of the normal electricity credit generators. So public charging, you know, the public transit applications would be eligible to generate incremental credits. They wouldn't be issued separately in that case, since they would probably just be using a fuel pathway code with carbon intensity of zero. So it wouldn't necessarily be a separate credit issuance. Their credit issuance would just be based on the carbon intensity of their fuel being zero. And then Greg, if your hand raised, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Greg with PGE. So I had a question for you, which is, let's see here. I'm sorry, I have lost my train of thought. I'll come back. My apologies.
No worries. Okay. I don't see anyone else's hands raised currently, so I'm just going to discuss the incremental aggregator. So this is what we're calling the proposal to create an entity that would generate incremental credits. It would basically function in a similar manner to the backstop aggregator that currently exists in the program for residential credits from utilities, from utility service territories where the utility has not opted into the program. We would go through a separate selection process. The existing backstop aggregator would not become the incremental aggregator unless that organization applied or was selected. The application process here largely mirrors what we're currently doing with the backstop aggregator. So we would hold a request for proposals. We would propose that, or we would review them as DQ staff. DQ staff, if we decided that one of the proposals was compelling, would propose selecting them as the incremental aggregator to the Environmental Quality Commission, which we do currently for the backstop aggregator. And then if the Environmental Quality Commission approves the selection of an incremental aggregator, then DEQ and the incremental aggregator would go through an agreement process. And if that agreement process is successful, then we would have the incremental aggregator in the system. And if that process isn't successful, we'd go back out to RFP. The draft rules were drafted prior to some of the most recent comments coming in from Friday to this morning. So we're still considering those comments currently. And, you know, I take the draft rules here as, you know, our first cut at them. And I think we have some additional thinking to do during the comments that come in. With that, we're at the end of this section. So are there any comments here are welcome. Michael Graham, I saw your hand raised first. Go for it. Go ahead.
Thanks, Bill. I was just curious if you had an idea of how many incremental credits we're talking about from the residential space. Incremental. Sorry, maybe I said that.
No, you said it right. We have some rough estimates. I don't have those numbers in front of me, and the one thing I know about my brain is that if I try and come up with it off the top of my head, I'm going to get it very wrong, so I'm not going to do that. You know, I think that if you look at the scenario tool that we published and look at the difference in credit generation from the current number of EVs in the state to at the statewide mix and fared, and then take it down to the zero carbon intensity mix, that would give you the number of credits from residential crediting. The number that would go to the incremental aggregator would obviously depend on, you know, what utilities opt in. I'd also note that the incremental credits would all be generated based off of the difference between base credit generation and a carbon intensity zero, if that's the RECs that are retired. So, for example, all of the utilities that have opted in for utility-specific mix, the increments would be between their utility-specific mix and zero. For a large number of those utilities, their carbon intensity is 4 or 5 grams, so I don't know that purchasing or retiring RECs on behalf of that to generate the relatively small increment would be economic.
And a follow-up question, if you don't mind. Would the proposed aggregator take the role of aggregating the credits from utilities that are already opted in, the incremental credits, or does that stay with the utility that's opted in?
Under the draft proposal, the utility would generate the incremental credits.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
No problem. I think I saw Jim have his hand up next, and then Annabelle, and then John.
Yes, Bill, this is Jim Lennon of BTR. And first of all, I just wanted to say to applaud you guys for trying to make sure that you do everything you can to make this a system that's workable for people who participate in it, but also be able to verify and certify and quantify and assure and validate that the credited greenhouse gas reductions are in fact real. And for that reason, as we've mentioned to you, we think a very important element of residential charging, certainly in the LCFS program, has been the large amount of empirical charging data that electric vehicle manufacturers are collecting on a daily basis with onboard telematic systems. And for that reason, we just think it's really important for DEQ to consider including that data as a component of residential incremental credit generation in the Oregon program, because we think it will really help DEQ more accurately quantify the reductions, the emissions reductions that are attributed both the incremental and base credits, and it'll help the agency provide the assurances that in fact these are real reductions. So just wanted to include that comment, and we will be following up with additional comments.
Gotcha. Thank you. Annabelle, you're up next.
Thanks, Bill. So a couple of things. I think the draft rule lays out eligibility for claiming residential incremental credits for both utilities and an incremental credit or an incremental aggregator. I think that's appropriate given that both entities can act in the public interest and on behalf of the kind of communities that they serve. And it wouldn't be appropriate to include other entities in, given that they may not be able to act, you know, on behalf of those residents. I think beyond that, getting to who has priority claim of these credits, right now, I think communities impacted, especially, you know, communities most impacted by climate change, as laid out in, like, the executive order, have differential access to the benefits of the Clean Fuels Program because of how the credits are claimed, unique to each utility service territory. And so this statewide approach really offers an opportunity to more equitably distribute the benefits of the program. And so I think in thinking about who has priority claim, There's a really strong case for a statewide incremental aggregator to act on behalf of those residents. And I think that should be considered. I think beyond that, if that is not the path that DEQ chooses to take, additional direction in the rule to ensure that vulnerable populations and impacted communities further benefit from this pathway in the Clean Fuels program will be needed. And so outlining what that looks like, maybe some additional oversight and criteria for those credits would be helpful, and happy to follow up on that.
Gotcha. Thank you. John, do you want to go ahead?
I just was going to make a comment on categories. You had categories, eligible categories, and I know it says may include, but you might think about being broad enough or maybe setting it more administratively. For instance, you have drayage trucks, that it might be medium and heavy-duty trucks, or it could include, you know, electric ground support equipment or car behind equipment. So maybe you want to think about those categories being sufficiently broad, or maybe having that done more administratively in between whoever the entity is that's managing that.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, then just to fly clear, folks, I didn't go into all the details of the incremental aggregator proposal. We, in those rules, we have a number of potential categories for spending for the incremental aggregator that we put in the rule. We also have, and I probably should have put this in the slides, but we got comments on it, and I think we're still considering those comments, how we would choose an advisory committee that would help DEQ determine what to have the incremental aggregator spend funds that it receives from credit sales on. Your comment was specific to that list of potential projects that they could spend funds on.
That's correct. I'm just saying maybe not have it so strict in regulation, but have a little bit more flexibility, because in a year or two or three, there may be other things that aren't quite on that list that might still be good projects to do.
Gotcha. Rhett, I see your hand raised. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. First, I just wanted to sort of second the comments that Annabelle made. Forth has weighed in support of the sort of statewide aggregator model, and think that provides the best benefits for, you know, distributing the proceeds most equitably and sort of accomplishing the aims of the executive order. I did want to sort of follow up on the Forth has a number of automaker members, and sort of wanted to follow up on that question. I saw some other additional written comments have been submitted by BPR of what role DEQ might see for, you know, for some sort of automaker role or sort of advisory piece in the equation. Just sort of curious what you might be thinking.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that the current advisory committee includes some discussion of we have a couple I should probably have the rules open for me, but I don't. This is part of the downside of not being in the office and being able to use the office printer as much as I'd like. We have a category in there that would have as part of the advisory committee, in addition to asking for folks that represent the communities that are affected by climate change and folks that are serving more equity interests, folks that are expert in transportation electrification. I think that would be a potential opportunity there for the direction of funds from the incremental aggregator under the existing proposal. All right, thank you. And then Eva, I see your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a kind of a clarifying question.
Uh-huh.
And again, I think in the draft rules it's proposed that utilities for the incremental credits would need to notify DEQ ahead of time of the plan to retire RECs on the incremental credits, and then prior to receiving those incremental credits would need to demonstrate that those RECs were in fact retired. And how would it work with a backstop aggregator? Like, where would those funds come from up front to purchase those RECs, assuming they would need to follow the same standard?
Yeah, so I think so the notification requirement there would be so that we would know and could inform the incremental aggregator in this case, you know, the amount of electric vehicle charging they would need to retire RECs on behalf of. For, you know, the incremental aggregator would need to have RECs that they could retire in order to generate the first tranche. They could then reimburse that from the credit sales, the CFP credit sales. You know, I think that would be something that we would, the DQ would discuss with any of the applicants is that, you know, do they have some existing source of funds that they could use for that time period between when they retire the RECs and, yeah, first to retire the RECs and then, you know, begin receiving revenues from credit sales. Thanks. And I've got a couple of questions in the chat that I'm going to go through quickly. So I'm going to prioritize the ones that have question marks and not the ones that are comments. So the first one from Marissa Bach at, I think, Shell, following up on Mark's question, so a fuel supply equipment owner can designate another party who is already participating in the CFP to be the credit generator on their behalf and file reports. So Marissa, yeah, so we're proposing that in the case where somebody who has electric vehicle chargers has designated another entity to be their aggregator and generate credits on their behalf, that the aggregator would also be allowed to generate incremental credits from that equipment and that charging. And it looks like the next two comments in here are comments and not questions, so I'm going to let folks read those on their own chat box. And I see Greg has his hand raised. If you remember the question from earlier, please go ahead.
Indeed I have. Thanks, Bill. So my question for you here is around, you had early on mentioned that, and we've talked a little about this, the owner of the particular service EV charging equipment doesn't generate the incremental credits that an incremental aggregator could do so, which I believe is all designed to be consistent with the way it works with base credits. I'm talking just on the non-residential side right mm-hmm. now. So my question is how that works exactly if, and maybe there's a good analog for in the current program that I'm not familiar with, but if with this new regime we're in with incremental credits, let's say a fleet operator decides, you know, we're not ready to, you know, we're not positioned yet to generate incremental credits, but we're going to work toward that. Mm-hmm. And so in the first year, you know, they're not generating the incremental credits that they could be. But in the second year, they begin to do that. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on how that would work and make sure that that option is available since they appear to be in the, you know, kind of first chair, as I think they should be, mm-hmm. as the owner or operator of the charging equipment, and that they kind of have the flexibility as they make decisions about generating incremental credits or, you know, be participating in a utility voluntary program that then facilitates that or that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a good question. So, and this kind of, and this does go back to one of the questions I asked earlier around if REC retirement with the quarterly reports in the middle, if that's enough time for folks. So what we would envision is that, you know, we would look at the data being reported to the Clean Fuels Program. We would determine, you know, what amount of charging, is being reported that, you know, is just the base credits and has no incremental credit claims. So, this is where I was talking about having multiple fuel pathway codes in the system, and I'm going to apologize to the folks who are not in our reporting tool, because this does delve a bit into the guts of how reporting works in our program. So we would have, you know, the existing statewide mix or utility-specific fuel pathway codes, and for an entity that is getting incremental credits, they would use either a fuel pathway code that represents, you know, one of those categories of RECs that is deemed to have a carbon intensity zero, or if there's a fuel pathway code associated with one of the other categories and went through a tier qualification process, that fuel pathway code would reflect. DQ would, on a periodic basis, inform the backstop, or the incremental aggregator in this case, that there are, you know, 10,000 megawatt hours worth of charging in the program that was reported against the statewide mix that they could claim incremental credits for, and it would be up to them to purchase and retire RECs on behalf of that charging. So if the credit generator, if a transit fleet, if a public charging station, you know, was reporting it to statewide mix and then decided that they were going to move on to a utility green power product, to get a carbon intensity of zero or to retire RECs in order to get a carbon intensity of zero. That would show up in our reporting. We would, you know, just, and we would exclude that from our future, you know, informing an incremental aggregate on how much non-residential charging is available to them to claim incremental credits for. Hopefully, yeah. There's anyone.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. I think so. It sounds like it is just a matter of the, you know, the operator changing the fuel pathway they report with, which sounds straightforward. So thank you.
Yeah, so if they report for the first year with statewide mix and then move to incremental credits in the second year, we catch that then, and it would not, that they would be the ones who generate incremental credits.
Or Bill, we might consider here too, I mean, some kind of notification requirement as well. You know, if somebody hadn't opted into the incremental but decides to at some point, maybe notification to the agency would be a good mechanism too, because I mean, I get it that, you know, like the amount of incremental credits going to the incremental aggregator at that point, I mean, it's not carved in stone, right? Because they don't know. But, you know, I would still think that the incremental aggregator might want some kind of heads up as far as kind of like what the quantities are going to them as opposed to not.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some kind of additional notification.
Yeah. I see your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Bill. I just wanted to comment on the Equity Advisory Committee and thinking about them being able to weigh on a kind of a majority of the residential incremental credit funds. And so just based on our comment letter that we submitted a couple weeks ago, just thinking about that kind of weighted responsibility that an Equity Advisory Committee would have regardless of what situation we find ourselves in as far as who is the aggregator of the incremental credits, and making sure that that the projects are you know, vetted by this Equity Advisory Committee to ensure that the projects are able to benefit equity communities in a responsible and correct way. Thanks.
Gotcha. Thank you. And yeah, I think this is one of the areas where we're looking at all the comments that they've been submitted through this morning and still trying to figure out how all the puzzle pieces fit together. Thank you very much for your comments. I'm not currently seeing any other hands raised or questions being asked in the chat. So, is that okay, so, Corey, I suppose you take a 10-minute break?
Well, no, can I pose a question before we go to a 10-minute break?
Yeah.
So I am kind of curious and I'm trying to think on the fly with the comments that were submitted from TV and Pacific Core this morning. So, you know, I think the wording in here is, you know, setting aside a portion of the money for, you know, that specifically benefits communities of color, communities of experience. You know, there's that language in that comment letter. So I guess I'm trying to, if you have some additional thoughts you want to share about, you know, how that wording kind of fits or doesn't fit into this role of the incremental aggregator. I mean, were you kind of envisioning that it would be an entirely different model outside of something that we would set up in the Clean Fuels program, or would it actually utilize the incremental aggregator or something else? And, you know, so, I mean, and if you haven't thought about it in that much detail, just let me know. But that's just kind of where my head is right now, just trying to integrate that.
Yeah, that's a good question, Corey. I haven't thought about it, and we haven't talked about it as a group either. So I could definitely get back to you on that. But definitely, I think just how it was proposed in the original language in kind of the resources that you provided to us as far as like a backstop aggregator having an equity advisory committee, I think just like making sure, like highlighting that and making sure that, again, like regardless of whatever scenario we end up doing, that there is an equity advisory component so that it's working alongside DEQ, and working alongside the person or the entity that is is that aggregator of the incremental credits. But I could follow up with you offline with our group as well, and definitely welcome others and the group that submitted comments on that to voice that. Thanks.
Annabelle or Jana, where do I go?
Yeah, I just wanted to add on top of these comments that, you know, I think the way it's outlined in the initial proposal, if DEQ, you know, were to appoint and convene that committee, I think what I think about of like how that committee is really going to thrive, and it might be from resourcing non-traditional stakeholders to participate in that process. And unless DEQ has a magical small pot of money to resource those groups, I think it makes sense for the incremental, whoever claims the residential incremental credits, to include that as part of their kind of reinvestment strategy to resource those groups, because they're really benefiting from the input that that committee provides.
Gotcha. Thank you. Jana, please go ahead.
Jana with Oregon Environmental Council. Yeah, I just love to plus one to what Dean and Annabelle said, and just add an additional kind of layer on top of that, that, you know, if we're talking about fleets and fleet owners, we want fleets and fleet owners at the table to say, like, how do you make this work? What are the challenges that you encounter? What are your needs? Similarly, for community-based projects, you need to ask community, what are your needs? What are the challenges that you face? And some of those will be unique, right, compared to a fleet-based project. And so that's the idea, I think, of the advisory committee that is resourced to be at the table and think through these, bring their expertise, but also kind of tailor projects. There may be things where, right, it's not only in the upfront cost of the vehicle, but ongoing operation and maintenance, right, to really make some community-based projects work. And so what are the unique attributes to really make these projects go? And that's where I think you really want that as an overlay. Appreciate, you know, the thinking that CD impacted to for their proposal that they laid out today. And, you know, without that type of input, then it still could fall short. So what's the role and opportunity there for that community-based engagement? And ultimately, again, like, you know, we're really excited about all of the different electrification opportunities, and many of the, you know, electrification anywhere and everywhere is really good for people because it cuts both climate and air pollution. So I'm excited about the other pieces of this rulemaking too, of the advanced credits, which I know we're going to talk about later. But for this in particular, I think it offers some really unique opportunities to think about what are some of those special cases where can electrification and transportation services really help? And it will look differently throughout the state.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. So now it's time for a 10-minute break. So, yeah, so it's 2:40, so how about we be back at 2:50 then? Okay?
All right. Thanks, everyone. All right. It's 2:50, so we're going to give folks another second or two to get back to their respective computers and then kick it off. Corey, is there anything you want to say up front?
And if you hear a random noise in the background, it's my son and my husband playing a very loud game of chess.
Yeah, I'm just glad my dog hasn't gone on a barking fit during this, but you know, I'm probably jinxing myself by saying that. Anyway, I think you guys are seeing why we were in the office for the prior meetings, and that is no longer possible. So, okay, I'm going to get us moving again so we can get you guys out by the time we post on the meeting. So for the next section, we're going to talk about the additional energy economy ratios we're proposing to adopt, and then also the EER-adjusted carbon intensity applications process that we have posted draft rules for. So I'm going to start with that application process. What hasn't changed since we talked about it at the meeting is that vehicle owners and operators may apply for vehicle-specific energy economy ratios. And I didn't put the energy economy ratio explainer slide in here, but just as a reminder, that is our way of comparing the energy efficiency of alternative fuel vehicles to internal combustion engine vehicles in order to accurately account for the carbon reduction associated with using that vehicle. And we have a number of these that are currently in one of our rule tables in Rule 8010. And what we're proposing here is that we folks come and apply to us, and we would adopt through a similar field pathway application process additional EERs that would be specific to the companies and operators that have applied for them. So this would not replace the values and the rule table, but we would just have the ability to, in a smaller way, approve additional EERs that would be specific to those applicants. What we're proposing is also that in addition to the vehicle owner and operator, the manufacturer of those vehicles may be a joint applicant with the in-state vehicle owner or operator. The vehicles in question in the draft rule are limited to vehicles that are powered by batteries or fuel cells. So it's not every alternative fuel drivetrain, it's just the electric drivetrains obviously hydrogen as well, but because the hydrogen fuel cells there are powering an electric motor. For the minimum data requirements, where the applicant or applicants must provide at least 3 months of operating data covering at least 300 hours of operation. We would also accept duty cycle testing. So this is testing where vehicles are being run on specified duty cycles. We would accept that data. However, the applicants would need to come and talk about it with DEQ prior to submitting the application, and that's so that we can discuss with the applicants which duty cycles they would be using in order to determine their appropriateness for whatever the vehicle's in-use real-world data would be. There are a number of duty cycles that are used by private entities along with EPA, the Air Resources Board in California, as part of their vehicle certification processes. And we would just want to have assurance that if duty cycle testing is being used as part of the basis for this, that they're picking a duty cycle that is reasonably approximate to what the vehicles will actually look like when they're being used on real roads versus just on the track. The other portions that haven't changed since the last proposal, so in the case of joint applications with the vehicle manufacturer, this actually is part we teed up, but has changed slightly in the last meeting. So additional vehicle owners or operators that are using the same vehicles covered by prior application. So, you know, if we get an application from some folks, and I'll go back to the farm track example. So if we get an application that has the manufacturer as a joint applicant for an electric tractor, if additional owners and operators in Oregon also get that same tractor, with the approval of the original applicants, we would allow the new owners of the, or operators of those vehicles to join on as a joint applicant after the original application. So they would be allowed to use that approved energy economy ratio value or adjusted carbon intensity. However, you know, they would need to get the approval of those original applicants, and the pathway conditions that we would attach to that approval along with the annual reporting requirements would apply to those new applicants. So they would need to submit data to us. And then DEQ would have the benefit in this case of having a broader data set of in-use data from these vehicles in order to determine if the initially issued energy economy ratio is accurate or if additional real-life testing data shows that the value should be adjusted upwards or downwards. And as I flagged much earlier in response to a question from Corey, we may require verification of the annual fuel pathway report for these applications on a case-by-case basis. You'll see that in the draft rules that we're reserving that as an option on the fuel pathway condition approval. The rationale for that is that, you know, if this is one operator and they're going to be generating, you know, 200 credits a year or something, then requiring them to go through the expense of verification may produce such a burden that it doesn't make sense for them to participate in the program. So we're trying to, you know, weigh what those costs are. We couldn't, in internal deliberations, we were thinking through, is there a way to just create a blanket test for this? And just given that we don't know what these applications will look like, how many entities may be involved, it made more sense for us to reserve that to a more of a process decision as we're looking at an individual application. So in terms of the approval process, both of these are taken from the draft rule text. So if we get an application in, DQ will use its judgment to decide, is it a good application or a bad application? Do we need more data? Does it seem reasonable, and does it seem like it, you know, one, isn't splitting an existing category, an energy economy ratio that should be used instead, is the EER that is being approved something that the agency should approve? If we believe that we should approve an application, what we're proposing is that we would present a review report with the proposed value back to the applicant or applicants. We would work with them to provide as much data as possible for a public comment period, so that we would go through with them to aggregate and summarize any submitted data to ameliorate concerns regarding trade secrets that might have been included in the applications. If they believe that the raw data set would constitute a trade secret, then we would work with them to aggregate it in a way that would allow external reviewers to understand why the agency came to its decision, and try to, you know, not redact as much as possible. We would then take that overall package, including the aggregated data, the review report, and any proposed pathway conditions, put that out for public comment. We're proposing a 30-day public comment period in the draft rule. We'd post this on our website. We would take comment likely via email, unless we have a better docketing system up and running at some point soon. Based on the comments received during that public comment period, DQ would decide whether it would move forward with the application and approving it, deny the application, or request additional information, or make modifications to their review report if we determined that, you know, there was an error or other factors should be included in the how the agency is reviewing the application. So if we make modifications to their review report, or if we get additional data that means that we change the value that we'd be approving, we would go back through the public comment process. So, you know, if we initially propose a value of 5 for a farm tractor, we get additional data that determines it's, you know, 4.5. We would put that 4.5 value and the rationale for the change, and any additional data we got back out to public comment, and then make that same determination on whether we should move forward with approving the value. So with that, that's the slides that we have for the ER adjusted carbon intensity application provision. I'll pause here, see if anyone wants to chime in or post questions in the chat box. Mark, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Just a question, kind of a general question, and maybe something I did not understand. So generally speaking, at least for light duty vehicles, normally the electricity that is provided to, you know, to the cars and vehicles that generate the credit. So you handle, but in this case, you're talking about having the vehicle owner operator generate the credit. So I'm not sure how that would work if you had some light duty vehicles that would want to apply for a different EER.
Yeah, that's a good question. So if we got that new EER value, I think we're still determining exactly how we'd implement this in the system, and if that would be a new fuel pathway code, or if we would just add another fuel application and EER value that folks could select. What the use of that energy economy ratio would be tied to the applicants. In many cases, we think, especially for some of the, you know, the vehicles that we would anticipate to apply for this are more likely to be commercial vehicles, as, you know, we don't think that there would be any light-duty electric vehicles that could be covered by this that wouldn't be operated by a company in general, right? You know, we're not looking at subdividing the, you know, electric car category that we have, so it wouldn't, you know, have like a Chevy Bolt EER versus a Tesla Model 3 EER, right? We would anticipate in a lot of these cases that these are fleets or companies would be owning these types of vehicles, and they would also own or operate the charging equipment for those vehicles. And they would have the ability to generate credits based on the EER that they've applied for. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Are there any other questions on this review? or on any aspect of the draft rules. Jana, please go ahead.
I just really appreciate this. I think this will allow more innovation to happen more quickly and create more opportunity for electrification credits per the mandate on this. And I like the flexibility to input on, you know, kind of applications between owner or OEM or whoever it may be. And then it feels like a 30-day public comment period gives adequate time, but is not too much process. So this feels like it's landing in a good spot.
Gotcha. Thank you. All right, I'm not seeing any further hands raised, so I'm just going to move on to the next section, which is the proposed addition of new energy economy ratios. This is actually one of the other areas where we haven't put out the rule text yet, but we will prior to the fiscal meeting. So we're proposing to add the electric cargo handling equipment, the NDCER, and the electric ocean-going vessel equipment NDCER. So these are the equipment here is what the energy economy ratios that the California Resources Board adopted is based on. So, you know, the various types of cargo handling equipment and also the shore power equipment that provides electricity to ocean-going vessels when they're at berth at the dock in order to so that they don't need to run their engines or their motors in order to generate electricity when the boat. We're proposing to adopt both of these and put these in rule table and one of the tables in 8-10. And then also, as was raised in during our last meeting, we're proposing to apply a displacement credit for alternative fuel forklifts for those with a model year of 2016 or later. What that means basically is that the energy economy ratio applies, appears twice in our credit calculation. I didn't put the equation in here. I think I told you guys why last time. But basically, the energy economy ratio divides the carbon intensity of electricity or in any other fuel source being delivered to an alternative fuel vehicle, and it's also used as a displacement credit as a multiplier on the energy dispensed. And the reason why that's the displacement credit is that if the vehicle is more efficient, if it uses less energy per mile than the alternative fuel drivetrain, we're giving them credit for the fact that less energy is being used in order to accurately capture the carbon benefit of using more efficient vehicles versus less efficient vehicles. We, back in our 2017 rulemaking, or 2018, they kind of blur together at some point, we proposed not having forklifts have the displacement credit applied to them. We are proposing to now allow that for model year 2016 or later vehicles, in line with the program start date and our when we set the baseline for the carbon intensities for our program. That's it on the EER slide, so I'll pause here to see if anyone has any comments or questions.
Just real quickly, Bill, I just wanted to ask, I know that we've had some kind of ongoing conversations about, you know, in addition to the electro cargo handling equipment and the ocean-going vessels, EERs, I think most prominently to discussions about airport-related ground service equipment. And I think the discussions that we've had with the port, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I know airports in the California area are in a process of doing an RFP and study to establish EERs for many of the airport-related equipment, and that will wait in the process to get the results of that study before we actually put them into our rules. Is that true, David?
Right. The California Air Force Council is, as you said, they put out an RFP last summer and are developing work to develop an EER, and we're coordinating with several California airports as part of that process. So I don't know at this time what the timing is at or what the timing is. But maybe a question, understanding that once that EER is developed, it has to then, to be adopted for the Oregon Clean Fuel Program, it has to then go through the rulemaking process. So what would that look like potentially as far as timing? And the reason I'm asking is because, you know, obviously the economy, current economy has been a game changer, but still generally there's interest by airlines in doing this, and it's a huge opportunity in fleet transition for us in Oregon. So I'm just trying to get a sense, and maybe this is a side discussion after this, but it's important to get a sense of the timing if we're waiting on rulemaking to have that happen.
Well, so with the ER-adjusted CI application process that we talked about earlier in the section, I think that value could come through there, and that would mean that we wouldn't have to wait for the next rulemaking. You know, I think if we were waiting for rulemaking, the next one, and Corey can correct me if I'm misremembering this, but, you know, we're targeting an ETC date somewhere in the second half of 2022. So, you know, that would be, the rules would go into effect at some point after that, most likely. So the EER application process would be the swiftest way if the ETC moves forward with this rulemaking and adopts these rules for us to add additional vehicles through that process.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, David. So I do imagine that you could go through the administrative process or the rulemaking to do like a full category will be later 2022.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and just to remind folks, right, the purpose of the application provision is so that we get more and better data on new vehicles as they're coming into the market and as they're starting to be used in Oregon. And then our intent is that once we have a sufficiently robust set of data for those vehicles, you know, we make determinations on if, you know, it makes sense to move that category from that, you know, approval process into the more categorical ERs and our rules. We're not trying to replace the existing ERs. We're just trying to get better data in order to better help with transportation and electrification of Oregon fleet through these provisions.
Yeah, so in addition to the airport-related equipment, we have quite a bit of conversation about e-trike, the application. And that's something we continue to work on, too. I think that's very promising. It's pretty close. We've got some data. We're evaluating that. It's not ready to go yet, but likely it might be a first candidate to get into, you know, process as far as administrative process about applying an EER. So we'll be approaching it that way with the e-trike. Okay.
I'm not seeing any other hands raised. I'm going to move on to the advanced crediting section. We had a lot of really good discussion with everyone 2 weeks ago. We have not posted a new draft of the rules, and we're still considering all the comments we've gotten over the last few days on the rule draft we put out last time, along with the comments we got at the advisory committee meeting. And actually, this slide is mislabeled because there is a change. It is describing the case for the previous proposal. So one thing that we are proposing to change based on our discussions with potential applicants is that DQ is planning to move the advanced crediting window so that a maximum of 6 years per vehicle can be advanced with a maximum payback period of 9 years. So if you have a vehicle that could apply for this provision, then you could get 6 years worth of credits up front, and you would have 9 years to pay back those credits for the program. We are still considering a number of comments around expanding the list of eligible entities, or we're also considering potentially revisiting that list in future rulemaking after we gain some more experience implementing this provision if it goes into effect. We're trying to determine how much administrative burden it would place in the agency, how many credits could potentially be issued from it. And on that latter point, we are also considering including a cap on the number of credits issued per year from this revision. We're still considering that as an agency, and we'd like to take comment on that. So I'll pause here if there are any other questions. Otherwise, we really do appreciate the discussion we had 2 weeks ago on this. It was really helpful for us.
Yeah, the mislabeling of this slide is my fault. I should have known that it's not a proposal. It's a change in the proposal. And just to be clear, it's this additional outreach that we've been doing this 6 years of the crediting window and the payback. You know, this is based on conversations we're having with transit agencies that are considering, additional electric buses. So that's kind of the baseline situation that we're working with here. Obviously, whether it's transit bus, school bus, garbage truck, whatever, kind of application, I know it changes a little bit. But we really kind of wanted to use that transit bus case as, we wanted to make it so that it makes sense for that case.
Mark, I see your hand raised first. Please go ahead.
Yeah, just to clarify, so last time I looked at the draft rule, it had like a 4 and 5 years, so the mm-hmm. posted on the website, I'm not the latest version then.
No, we have not, haven't gone into edit these rules again yet. We'll be doing that before the next meeting. That is what we'd be changing, is that we put a maximum of 6 years of crediting per vehicle, and then changing the payback period to 9 years.
Okay. Yeah, in the rulemaking or the proposed language that was posted, what wasn't clear was a 4 and 5 years, and the language that said, no more than 1 year. I mean, there were. It wasn't clear for how long essentially the loan could apply.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, maybe you want to clarify that and probably put some limits on the amount of those types of credits. And the major concern I have is the definition. I think you start up with a definition of or saying that those credits have to be kind of real credits and all of that, but how do you define a real credit? What's in the it's a future credit. So, what's the definition of real when it's in the future?
I appreciate your comment. We will work at clarifying the language as we move forward. And I think that the confusion that you're discussing around the number of years is probably where I want to put it in the rule more explicitly. So we'll be improving that as before we put the rules. The draft rules back out. On your latter statement, the agency views these credits as real credits. They're just being issued in advance of the carbon intensity reductions being actually achieved in the transportation fuel pool. But we think that, and that was part of, where Corey and I have been having discussions with transit agencies, part of the goal of this provision is that we actually get these additional vehicles on the road that will generate credits, and move the needle towards having additional purchases that will result in more carbon intensity reductions in the program. We do view these as real credits and that we'll get paid back to the program. I think that, we have a number of provisions in the draft rule that we'll be keeping that are intended to ensure that those reductions do occur. And in the event that they don't occur by the end of the payback period, that the applicant who receives the advanced credits must make the system whole by purchasing retirement credits. If this is a loan, we don't have a default provision, so, they would need to buy and retire other credits in order to make sure that the system remains whole in order to protect the environmental integrity of the program. So, thanks. Do you have any response to that?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Annabelle, I see your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, so. I just wanted to say that as far as who's eligible for advanced credits, the Northwest Energy Coalition supports, the current recommendations. There was a comment that I was reading, I believe from, as a lot of clean fuel program tabs open right now. I believe it's from, Julie Whitcover with, UC Davis. And she had an interesting comment that I wanted to second. Just around, DEQ, to the extent that you're able to, providing a formula and protocol for these entities to be able to follow, so that it hopefully kind of streamlines the process for them estimating the amount of credits. I think just trying to make things as easy as possible for these entities so they can actually use the pathway.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. And that was also something that Kelly Hale from Lane Transit District, the transportation agency down at Eugene, raised. Our goal is to, in the application materials, when we put them out, provide as much detail and insofar as it is possible for us to do so, some just default calculators based on our obligation estimator to make the application process easier for them, and also to ensure that we, get good applications that don't require a lot of back and forth. I think that makes sense for both us and the applicant. If the rules are approved in March, we would hope to have the first application window at some point in the middle of next year. So I think it'll be a little bit of a race on our side to see how much of that we can get together while balancing other program responsibilities. But our goal is to, try and provide some protocols and default calculators that people can use.
Yeah, and I'll jump in here and add to Annabelle. So this is, I think this is an idea that's in my head that I haven't really, fleshed out to, but I think for those of you that are also involved in maybe some of the statewide transportation strategy work, the Every Mile Counts works, there is a task in there that is kind of referred to as, I believe, it's the truck alternative fuels study. And I think that this is an opportunity for, work within DEQ to support this kind of rollout implementation of advanced crediting provision. So in the case of, I think we've talked here a lot about transit agencies or school buses, it's taking the opportunity for the folks that are working on this alternative fuel standard study to put together materials and outreach and ways that we can really demonstrate to these fleets not only the opportunities in the Clean Fuels Program, but other funding opportunities, other grant opportunities, how you can stack these things to really start to move the needle on, making big changes in these sectors. And so I think there will be some natural crossover with the opportunities for these advanced crediting if it moves forward with that additional outreach and support and, technical support and financial support on the grant side too for this.
It sounds like a good opportunity to leverage some of the other activities across state.
Thanks, Eva. You're up next. Please go ahead.
Yeah, so Pacific Corp and PGE filed some comments and our joint comments on this. Glad to see the extended consideration that, especially given some of the discussion last time that I've seen, as well as continuing, and you mentioned that the discussion is ongoing on eligible entities, but looking at this as a pretty major opportunity to support transportation electrification in the state on an accelerated timeline. Broadly, as this can be applied within reason, we're really supportive of that, as well as, in the case of private fleets that serve a public good. I think, the airport is an example of this, but there's lots of different examples around the state where it might be the fleet operator itself is private, but it's contracted with a state entity or otherwise to provide public transportation or other transportation services that might apply. So continuing to consider that, we really encourage you to do so.
Yes, thanks for that, Eva. I mean, that is definitely something that even just earlier today, Bill and I were going forward back and forth about, we use the word kind of public service, which is service, pretty broadly. We know that it means it's a positive, providing a benefit to the community kind of word, right? But maybe we need to work on, defining it, or maybe using a different word as opposed to service, I think is one of the things that's crossed my mind. And then I think the other word, that is kind of currently in there is contracted with. And I know that not everything is a contract, that there's other kinds of partnerships, agreements, what have you, between private entities and public governments as well, and trying to, capture that in the right way so that things like at the airport, can get covered. Because I think that, that's a good example, I think that's a kind of a fleet where we want to have this provision applied to. And so, I've reached out to David bringing at the port, and I think he's got some, you know, the alternative language that might work. You know, so if you do have alternative language for how to capture some of those additional seat stains, then we're looking at how better to characterize that in the draft rules.
Real quick, I really appreciate your perspective and the importance of that to what's clearly an Oregon-dedicated fleet and one that serves the public good, the traveling public out of Oregon. So it is a great opportunity, and I appreciate your perspectives on that.
Thanks. Greg, you're up next. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just add to what Eva said that, you know, we're excited about the advanced crediting piece. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. Regardless of, you know, where we actually land in terms of eligibility, there's a lot of promise for that tool. So I'm glad to see it evolving. Would just note, as we did in our comments, that, you know, we encourage TEQ to make sure that that opportunity is available without any barriers that aren't necessary to, you know, protect the program or provide DEQ the information it needs. One thought is just around the 15-year requirement for light duty. There certainly may be public entities, smaller public bodies that are ready to electrify a handful of light duty electric vehicles, but may not have a fleet plan that is, you know, in hand, blessed by their, you know, their governance board or whatever it might be, and ready to go. And, you know, I imagine we would also want them to be able to move forward with those kinds of things. So we just encourage, you know, some thinking through, how you want to approach that piece. And, if, you know, the objective with that item is to make sure that the advanced credits are going where there's really a price differential. There may be other ways to get at that on the light duty side. So just wanted to mention that piece.
And if you'd like to file written comments on what you meant at the end there by how to go to the price differential, we would welcome them. Jana, do you want to go ahead? You're up next.
And with Oregon Environmental Council, we also are, you know, appreciate the careful thinking around this and certainly would be very interested over time, too, to think about how to expand that eligibility. I think the question really is less about, like, public versus private, maybe, and more about risk, right? So if it's an entity that's only been, you know, a month old and it's like, I plan on being here, you know, I want 70 vehicles, like, that feels riskier, and it feels like there may be a better thing to do is think about kind of risk factors for the entity that's applying, because that's the more thing, right? Like, can these things be guaranteed into the future? What's the risk or not? But I do agree that these are real credits. These are real things that get real emissions. And then the sooner we can get things online, you know, the better for the program and for the climate. So I do think that this is a great opportunity.
Thank you. And then there is one question in the chat from Michael Graham with Columbia Willamette Clean Cities. What is being considered for the annual cap for advanced credits? We're still in our initial thinking around that. I think the closest analogous provision in the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard is their capacity crediting provision, which between the two different forms of capacity crediting places a limit of, I think, 5% of the deficits that were most recently generated each quarter on the overall number of credits that can be issued as capacity credits. I think 5% of annual credit or deficit generation might be a starting point, but we do welcome comments on that. I think we're still trying to work that through internally and think about what makes sense here and, you know, what provides some guardrails. And I see Michael raised his hand, so please go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Sorry, follow-on question. What's currently envisioned for the application process? For instance, are you looking at a rolling application process? Is it a first-come, first-serve? Are you looking at establishing certain criteria? And then also, would DEQ consider having kind of like an overarching goal to focus on certain sectors of the public 1 year or another, just because I worry that if we do go forward with this provision that there's going to be few credits and it's just going to be a rush to get your application in?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we, in the draft rule, I'll note that we say that we'll prioritize vehicles that will be deployed in areas of the state that have a high air pollution burden or that have other equity considerations or climate adaptation considerations associated with them. I don't remember the exact language off the top of my head, but that was the intent of that provision. Because we have not yet drafted the cap into the rule and haven't gone through the priorities, how we would decide to prioritize, I think that is something that we would need to consider as we put into effect the cap, if we, move forward with adding one to this provision. In terms of your first question about how we're envisioning the application process working, where the draft rule we put out for the last meeting says it will hold at least one application window a year. I think we would consider, so we'll have at least one period a year. We warn people ahead of time. We give them, the application materials ahead of time. And we take all the applications at that point. We may hold multiple rounds. I think that's going to be something that, if we get a huge number of applications in one window and, we hit the cap, if we can move forward with one, I don't think we'd hold another one. But if we get a smaller number, it might make sense to hold multiple per year. I think that's something that we're considering on our end from, just managing workload and other things. If we, part of the rationale when I said earlier that we'd likely hold one in the summer is that that's insofar as the clean fuels team has downtime, late summer usually is when we have some, since we're past annual reporting, that things are relatively more stable in terms of workload at that point. But I think that's something that we would, the workload considerations is part of what we're thinking through there.
That sounds good. Just an initial brush. I might check with some of our members to see how that aligns with their procurement strategy and and just their budget cycle, so that they have enough funding should they be awarded to fund the remaining portion of a vehicle or equipment.
Yeah, and we just say at least once per year. I'm saying summer because I think that's the earliest we could do it if these rules do go into effect next year. If we get a number of comments from applicants saying that, no, please hold it in December, I think that's something we would consider. We're trying to keep the rule language itself relatively flexible here.
Cool. Thanks. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, this is the only slide we have on the advanced crediting provision. Are there any other folks who want to weigh in? I'm not seeing anything else in the chat currently. Oh, Annabelle, please go ahead.
Just had a quick question. There were some other kind of requests in or recommendations in the comments submitted to expand some of the eligibility or expand, eligible entities. I'm curious if DEQ is considering adding those to the rules. And if so, are there any other provisions or guidelines that you would attach to those?
Yeah, like we said in the slide, right, we are considering, how to modify it. As Corey mentioned, we're looking at ways that we could draft that to be a little bit broader than what we currently have. Going back to what Jana said a moment ago, a lot of that discussion internally is around, risk to the program and the environment around, is this a one-month-old private entity? Is this an entity that we have reasonable assurance these vehicles will be used in Oregon or not? Because obviously the credits need, then the vehicles need to be used in Oregon or to generate credits on the program. So, if we have somebody buy 5 electric garbage trucks and then immediately move them up to Seattle, that doesn't work for us because, we're a state agency and we don't try and trot on ecology's authority generally. I think that we're thinking that through and what additional guardrails might be necessary if we do have a broader application beyond what we currently have in the draft rules.
Yeah, let me add to that, Annabelle. I think, I know what you're probably referring to is I know that there are comments submitted about, other nonprofit organizations. I mean, that's something that we've talked a lot about and trying to kind of figure out kind of the case of how a nonprofit would apply. Would it be light-duty vehicles? Would it be heavy-duty vehicles? What kinds of services do they provide? What other opportunities do they have? Are we talking about more of a pilot situation where I think a lot of the opportunity right now has been, you know, with, say, utility grants, right, and getting those kind of initial projects done. Are there nonprofits that are kind of ready to do a bigger fleet conversion, right? Maybe they've done their pilot, maybe they've got their couple of vehicles and they've seen the light and they want to do more, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing we're trying to figure out. You know, I think that's a great public service kind of application, and just trying to figure out how to kind of capture that.
And for private charging providers?
Oh, yeah, the DC Fresh Charger is the other kind of model that has come up in the comments here. And I think the comments that we got were good, because I think when we talked about it before, you know, what's hard for us on our side in this provision is how to forecast what the potential is for the credit generation, right? I mean, you know, part of the reason why, you know, the fixed fleet makes sense is because we know how many miles, how many electricity, where you can kind of figure that out. And so we're trying to figure out what that equivalent is to for DC fast charging. And I think one of the comments was specific to, like, say, rural areas, right? I mean, in places where you really need that DC fast charge to fill a gap. And so I think that's another place, if there are more specific comments about how that should be structured, I think that would be helpful as well. Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, I know for those of you that are paying attention to the TINA analysis that the Department of Transportation is kicked off, I think it was yesterday. It seems like a long time ago, but I think it was yesterday. But there is definitely discussion between us and ODOT about the timing of their study and what the outputs are going to be. I think if you go all the way back to our first meeting, I stated the intent to align those two kind of studies, and I think timing might be kind of one of the things that doesn't line up right now. I think they're scoped to go out until the middle of next year with their study. They just kicked off yesterday, and so you know, I'm not sure if, you know, I mean, I think as I envisioned it a while ago, it's like there would be a provision in this rule that says, if it's infrastructure that's identified by TINA to be critical to a gap or something, you know, that we could have put it in. But we're not going to be able to kind of do that real time for this rulemaking, but potentially in the future. I think that's definitely an opportunity.
That's really helpful. I appreciate you clarifying that.
So this person isn't a real name, but their handle is ODOT11, so I'm guessing that's from the Department of Transportation. You want to go ahead?
Maybe Mary Brazel, maybe?
Yes. Hi, this is Mary Brazel. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Yes, I've talked to my computer support people about why my computer number comes up instead of my name, but we have not figured out that. So, yes, I am the mystery ODOT11L. I just wanted to corroborate what Tori Ann said, that we actually had our meeting on Tuesday, but but we the study is due to the governor's office. The Transportation Electrification Infrastructure Needs Analysis is due to the governor's office by the end of June in 2021. And while we will have proposals well before that will be being vetted and reviewed, it will not be finalized until that time. So, but I also want to corroborate that Tori Ann and I and other parts of ODOT and DEQ are definitely in conversations with one another about how the studies can work together and support one another.
Gotcha. Thank you. And there is one two questions in the chat from one person that I'll take now. Some from Marissa Bach from Shell, and again, remind me if I'm actually getting affiliation wrong. Is there a restriction on how proceeds from these credits can be spent? Also, will it publicly be announced how many credits are advanced? So, Marissa, the draft rule does not have a restriction on how the proceed from these credits can be spent currently. I think given the draft rules had a relatively narrow list of entities, and also crediting was directly tied to vehicles or equipment being placed in service, We didn't feel like that restriction was necessary because it would be, part of the statement of need that the applicant would be making to us around, how this would help them, purchase those vehicles, purchase that equipment, and, advance transportation electrification in Oregon as part of their advanced credit application. In terms of will it publicly be announced, any credits are advanced. So I think that we would likely publish both a list of successful applicants to the program for these credits. I think that we would need to work through an implementation, exactly what we would publish. I think that at the very least be, these organizations and, potentially some estimate of how many credits would be advanced. Again, the issuance of the credits only occurs when they get the vehicles, get the charging equipment, and put them into service. So for the actual number of credits being issued under this provision, we would likely add that in as a line item in the quarterly data summaries that the Clean Fuels Program puts out. We'd probably call out that crediting separately, and we'll do it that way. At least that's my initial thinking. That's something that we'll think through, and if you want to follow comments on that, we'd be happy to take a look. I'm not currently seeing any other hands raised or questions or comments in here. This is one area where we really do appreciate all the comments we got from all of you through written comments and from the last meeting, and we're looking forward to reopening these draft rules and getting an updated version out for the fiscal. So with that, I'm going to move on to the last section here. That's a bunch of miscellaneous provisions because we didn't find a better way to bucket them. So in terms of electricity credit generation, we haven't really changed this from last time we discussed it. So we're planning on moving to semi-annual crediting for residential charging. That's due to the DQ gets the DMV database every 6 months for other applications within the agency, and so that's when we get updated accurate EV counts throughout the state so we can then geolocate utility service territories. So we're planning to move to every 6 months for that crediting based on that cycle of data that we get from our partners at ODOT. And also in terms of the electricity credit generators, this will also be second half of adding those EVR values. We're proposing in the draft rules that are out for electricity credit generators that the owner or the operator of the charging equipment for electric cargo handling equipment is the entity that is eligible to generate credits, and that the owner of the charging equipment for shore power for ocean-going vessels is the entity that's eligible to generate credits. Both of them can designate an aggregator, and this mirrors the credit generator for these applications in the California LCFS rules. I'm not seeing any comments or questions there. Okay. On residential credit proceeds reporting, what hasn't changed since the last proposal is that we're proposing that utilities be required to report at least annually on the monetization of the residential electric vehicle credits and what proceeds were spent on. We are proposing, and this is a slight change, that we make those reports due at the end of January. So our question out to the various utilities is, does that timing work for you guys? My understanding from discussions with Public Utility Commission staff is that the UM 1826 docket does not currently have a report that quite meets what we're asking for down below here. So there wasn't a timing that we could line up with whatever that report would be due. So we're proposing end of January here, but we do want to take comment on that. We would not have an enforcement action on failure to submit a report, but we would withhold future residential credits from an entity that fails to file one of these reports. So they would go, the residential electric vehicle credits would go to the backstop and or incremental aggregator as appropriate. The reports must include, and this was from one of our initial papers, and also I'll just note this section is one that we don't have rule language up yet for, and we're working on that now. The report must include total revenue from the sale of base and incremental residential electric vehicle credits as appropriate, and the percentage of that revenue that went to Clean Fuels Program-related administration costs. The percentage of that revenue that went to administering any programs, including but not limited to project management, developing and managing contracts, and a description of the programs that were covered by CFP revenue and the amount spent in each category. And since the dog wants to weigh in on that one, finally, I'll pause here and take look for hands raised or questions being asked in the comments.
Greg raised his hand, so that's good. So the first point, you know, I think in your comment letter spoke to, you know, an interest in doing like one report that would satisfy both DEQ and PUC kind of reporting requirements. And this was just basically the intent is to incorporate this here. And so, you know, we propose the January based on some conversations we had with you, but you know, obviously we just want to coordinate the timing of that.
Yeah, and just a reminder, this would also apply to the folks that are not regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. So Greg, your hand was up, and then Eva, please go ahead.
Sure, this is Greg. I'll just say I think January 31st for a report like this works for us. We expect to be getting on a regular cadence of reporting kind of information to the Public Utility Commission anyway toward the end of each calendar year. And so January 31st for the Clean Fuels Program provides a little bit of the flexibility there, which is always good around the turn of calendar year. So I think that can work on our end.
Okay, thank you. Eva, please go ahead.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna need to check in internally, especially with our accounting folks who manage a lot of how we track our current credit monetization process and, you know, tracking, assigning costs to different cost centers. But I think that turns into a little bit, especially with the addition of incremental credits. So currently the way the system works, for folks who don't operate as a utility in this space, all of the credits for both residential base credits as well as the credits that we claim quarterly on the stations that we own and operate or have incentivized through either rate payer funded programs or clean fuel funded programs and then have to be applied to those cost categories. If there is any way in the system to create more than one account, particularly, like, I think the most helpful would be having a residential credit account covering both base and incremental and then kind of the charging equipment, that would really help, I think, from a simplified tracking and then therefore improve the reporting process.
The latter point we'd have to discuss offline, since that's more on the technical end of the reporting system.
Understood.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we throughout January seemed like a good date, but yeah, let us know what in comments. Actually, Jennifer, do you want to go to see your hand raised?
Thanks. I'm still kind of digesting the rules, but would the penalty, I guess, of not being able to participate, would that be time limited, like for the next year or forevermore? Or?
You know, I think we're still working on the rule language here. I would envision this as probably being that, you know, if you submit the past due reports that you could start claiming credits again, assuming that they haven't been issued to somebody else at that point. So it would be time limited. It wouldn't be forever. But, you know, we do want to have some hook to ensure that entities do submit the reports as required.
Right. That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. And again, I'll just remind folks, we've mentioned this earlier in the provision, but the intent here is that we would DEQ would then collect and publish these reports that there's increased transparency to the public and to the residential electric vehicle owners on what the value is being spent on. I'm not seeing any other hands raised from folks who didn't speak yet. Is there any other questions in the chat? Otherwise, we'll move to our public comment period in just a moment for more general questions or comments on the rulemaking. Michael, please go ahead.
The cycling back to advanced crediting, mm-hmm. you said 5% of the deficits in the previous quarter. Did I mishear you that it was the quarter and not the previous year?
So my recollection is that the California provision operates on a quarterly basis because the credits are under that provision are issued every quarter for, under the capacity credits. I think that given that we're looking at a one-year cycle and that also the credits would all be advanced at once when the electric vehicle or charging equipment is put into service, that in using 5% of the deficits over the year would make more sense in this case. But that's just initial thinking, and we haven't fully worked it through internally.
Cool. Thanks, Bill.
No problem. Okay, with that, I'm going to move to the broader public comment period. Does anyone have anything else they want to say about or questions they want to ask? Was there anything in the draft rules you saw and were curious about that we didn't cover here? Evan, please go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. Just a general question across all of these draft rules, and this may not be answerable, but how final are these draft rules?
They're not final. We put out these draft rules for our fiscal analysis, right? Because we need to have draft rules out for the rulemaking advisory committee to consider as we work through the potential impact of these provisions, and so that Corey can write fiscal notes for. And then we can get comment on it at our next meeting on December 1st. The rules in question are in draft form. We still need to still be internal and DOJ review of them prior to us formally proposing them. And then obviously when we put things out in a notice of proposed rulemaking, it is still a proposal, and we will take comments during the public comment period and may make changes prior to us taking these rules to our Environmental Quality Commission for their review and potential approval next year. So there is still a fair amount of change that can occur. I would say that, we have been attempting to workshop these provisions with everybody so that we, have a fairly good idea about where we're going. But, I've definitely been in rulemaking where we've had to make fairly significant changes later in the process.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Evan, I would just kind of describe this as draft. When we get to, like Bill said, it's for the purposes of trying to assess the fiscal impact. When we get to the notice of proposed rulemaking, I would consider that as like final draft, right? But then we're still taking comment on it. There are lots of times when we get lots of comments during that formal comment period of that final draft, and then we make changes prior to going to the final kind of recommendation to the commission. So. Where there's at least two big kind of steps between now and when the rules actually go to our commission.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And I think we got to everything that was in the group chat as well.
I believe we have. Okay. So Corey, do you want to take the next step slide?
Yeah, why don't we kind of like do next steps and wrap this up. So as Bill alluded to, the next meeting and the final meeting for this draft will be on December 1st. That's 2 weeks. No, it's December 1st. It's a Tuesday. We got off of this Thursday cadence because of Thanksgiving. But it'll be on December 1st. It'll be in the afternoon at 1 o'clock. And I believe the information is already posted on this, on the rulemaking advisory committee webpage. Again, if you have comments that are significant as far as to the fiscal impact, please get those in as soon as possible. I am currently already writing the fiscal and really need it to get, routed for internal review early next week. And so if you can get me those specific ones that are, specific to fiscal impact by Monday, I would really, really, really appreciate it. If not, if you have broader comments that we can just, again, if you have comments on that we can don't necessarily impact the fiscal statement, then the comment deadline here is out to the following Monday, to November 30th. And those will be considered as we draft the notice of proposed rulemaking. So that's kind of the timing of that. Again, our email address below for the rulemaking is CFPE2021@dc.state.org.us is where you should be sending all the comments. I think that's it. Any questions about next steps or process, those kinds of things?
Hey, Corey, this is Greg from PG. Just curious, for the fiscal impact, what are the kinds of questions you have to answer for that?
Sure. Yeah, the general concept behind this is that, what we're tasked with doing is trying to anticipate whether there will be impacts economic and fiscal impacts based on these rule changes. So it could be positive, it could be negative, it could be additional costs, burdens, it could be additional opportunities for credit generation and revenues. We do think about program costs, administrative costs, costs that could be passed on to consumers, costs for companies to actually implement these new provisions. Again, I ask you to limit the we're required to just look at the impacts of these proposed changes, which is why we have to do this draft rule kind of exercise, so that you have an idea of what kinds of things that might be required of you. My gut feel is just based on most of this conversation, a lot of what we talked about are opportunities and benefits for additional credit generation, which would lead to additional revenue. So those are positive impacts. But obviously, especially if we talk about some of the, the REC requirements, right? There are costs associated with purchasing the RECs and administering and just, going through that process. Those are considerations that we have to think about as well. We're not required to do this formal economic analysis. We are required to use existing information, which is why we will ask you lots of questions. You, the stakeholders, lots of questions about how much do you think this is going to cost, or how much do you think you can, it takes to do this, or how many hours, or with reporting requirements, and that's why we ask those kinds of questions, so we can get an idea about how much it costs. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what it is. I think we look at the affected parties, we look at the general public as a whole, we look at consumers, we look at the agency, the cost of an ability for the program to actually administer and implement these provisions, and and the resources that are needed to do that. So it's pretty broad. In addition, we're also required to ask whether any of the proposed changes have specific impact to small businesses. And if the answer is yes, and then it's to consider ways to change the proposals and maybe modify it so that that impact be not as great. So that's a specific question that we'll be asking at the December 1 meeting as well.
Mark, I see you raised your hand. Please go ahead.
Yeah. On the advanced crediting specifically, I'm not a law person, I don't know from a legal standpoint, but the advanced crediting is essentially enabling a free loan to public agencies. So obviously that may be seen as a positive thing, right, for those agencies? Not necessarily the EQ, right, but the ones who would be benefiting from that. But I don't know around the legality of that and you know, how you factor that in. I don't know if you know, you or your lawyers have thought about this, or whether there's any issues to provide essentially free loans to state agencies or local agencies through this kind of a program. Just a thought here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's something that we have to take into account. A lot of times how this is addressed is, you know, we talk about a range of possible outcomes and how that would change. You know, I think to your point, you know, it's kind of like the payback periods and, you know, and the kind of time period we're dealing with, just, you know, how much is upfront cost versus delayed cost and, you know, those kinds of things. And so, you know, some of that analysis I would characterize more as qualitative responses as opposed to quantitative, you know, to get people into ballpark, just consider what those impacts are. Jennifer, did you still have your hand raised? Did you still have a question?
No, sorry about that.
Okay. Anything else? Are we done two minutes early maybe this time? I definitely appreciate all of your energy today. I know many of you were on Zoom calls earlier today with the PUC. All of this work is very important, and you know, I know you have to deal with the regulatory processes a lot, and you know, it's very much appreciated to be able to kind of get your perspective about this and that and all these other things that are kind of moving around in the discussions, and very much appreciate the attention that we can get from you on this. There's a lot of things that we've already, you know, new things that we've considered and listened to the comments and whatnot. So it has all been very, very valuable, and I'm very much looking forward to the next discussion about the fiscal. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all for hosting and coordinating.
Thank you.